Still alcoholic.
Hey, Bill.
I wanted to comment a little bit on something we were talking about at the end of the last session about working with people and giving advice, and, you know, if they don't follow the advice, and what do you do with somebody that's got a preconceived notion about what they will and won't do? I think Matthew answered it extremely well, is you just love them. I mean, live minicam report, there's an alcoholic behaving badly. News at 11, you know, I mean, all of us have been resistant to the advice that we get. We want to do what we want to do. Guy asked me years ago, he says, Bill, have you ever considered the fact that you could be completely wrong? And the answer is no, I never considered that. When I think I'm right, I think I'm right. But what kind of advice do we really give? And the classic story that I, because when I'm new in AA, I need some good advice. I need somebody to help me decide what to do. I don't know what to do. This guy comes to me and he says, I'm thinking about marrying the nude dancer. What do you think? And I told him, I said, well, probably not a good idea. But if you do, I'll come to the wedding. Because I wouldn't want to miss this for the world. And I think we all deserve to have our own experience. And my job as a sponsor is I'm not going to throw you away from making a bad decision or even a series of bad decisions. Now, if you're not staying sober, if you're not doing the basic stuff, if you're not going to meetings, if you're not working on your inventory, if you're just not doing anything and you keep drinking and coming back, ultimately I'm going to look at you and I'm going to say, what are we doing here? What is this? Clearly you don't want what I have because you're not doing what I do. So I'm not going to fire you, but that doesn't mean I have to be nice to you. Mm-hmm. You know, I will confront you ultimately. I'll confront you. And I'll bring to your attention your behavior and what it is you're doing and what I think you need to do in order to stay sober. I mean, everybody I sponsor has a right to my opinion. You know? They do. They ask. They ask for help. And I will ultimately give it to you. I have not fallen victim to this erroneous thing that we don't give advice or express opinions. If we didn't do those two things, we wouldn't have anything to say to each other, you know? I mean, I will ultimately give you my opinion about how you're living your life.
And Cliff Roach used to say, the one sentence that sums this all up is, if alcohol doesn't make you want to work the steps, sobriety sure will. Mm-hmm. And you just get uncomfortable. You get uncomfortable until you're willing to do that thing you weren't going to do. Do you want to start with a question, Jeff?
Sure. What is an alcoholic? What is an addict? I think that after 32 years of being in the program, I've got perfect metaphor for this. It can all be explained in our relationship to carpeting. An alcoholic, we've been out for 3 or 4 days drinking. We find some place, it's safe, it's warm, it's carpeting. And just curl up and go to sleep on it. For the drug addict, carpeting is a never-ending source of hope and entertainment.
Very well done. Bill?
Drug addicts are sleazier than alcoholics.
There's your answer.
We can spot you from a mile. Can you give ideas, hints, or tests to distinguish between our will and God's will? This is a classic thing that you hear in AA all the time. You hear it talked about in meetings. We've all used it at one time. There's God's will and there's my will. My opinion, but it's a really good one. About this is, I think that it's the height of arrogance that we would think that we could actually have a battle of wills between ourselves and the power that drives the entire universe. Once again, we have separated ourselves from all of nature. There is the will of the universe, and then there's my will, because I'm separate from everything. And I absolutely believe that's part of the bondage itself. It's self-obsession. It's an illusion. Completely erroneous. There couldn't possibly be a difference between my will and God's will. I only think there is. And I'm going to have this internal struggle no matter what. That God is outside me. It's separate from me. It has a separate will. And I have to go there and achieve that and bring it into me or adjust my behavior and my will accordingly in order to be accepted by it because it's separate from me. And I just don't think that there's any difference. I think it's a spurious argument. There just couldn't possibly be. You know, I mean, I do what I do because that's what I do. And this thinking mechanism up here, this egoic mind, applies certain motivations to it, and it separates it, and it compares it to other things that it sees around it. And the truth is, there is no separation. There's nowhere to seek. It's all right here. I'm connected to it all the time. My job is to eliminate whatever it is that stands in the way of my being able to grasp that, to get that, to understand that. The gurus in the spiritual movement call seekers, the term that many of them use for seekers, people that are seeking spirituality or seeking God, miserable seekers. They're miserable because they're seeking and there's nothing to find. It's all right here all the time, and we are under the illusion that is outside of us. And a really good example is this statement. That this belief that there's a separate nature between myself and God. We've all used it as part of the human condition. It seems real. It's not wrong. It's not incorrect, and it needs to be corrected. It's just a statement of our position of how outside the circle we are. And I have to have every experience that I have to have in order to grow spiritually and come to understand. If I want to think that I've got a separate will and I'm doing battle, well, what the hell? Why not? Go ahead, think that. My personal experience is that there just isn't any difference.
Can I pin your balloons to the ground?
Certainly.
Okay. So, I agree with what Bill said. But I like to apply that because I understand the question and give my experience. Nay, I agree with what Bill's saying. It's conceptual that we are. It's about powerlessness, is what you're saying. We're pretending we have power. But when I was new, raised in a Catholic school, terrified of God, really wondering if I could get this, I went to my sponsor about the 11th step, and I said, I don't understand, prayed only for knowledge of God's will for me. That seems so ambiguous. And the real motivation behind my question is I don't want to know God's will for me. God hates me. That's how I grew up thinking about God, because of the... So, you know, I always use the example when I was 14, a nun looked at me and said, if you're thinking about sex, you're going to hell. I was like, I'm going to hell then, because I sometimes don't think about sex when I'm brushing my teeth. I'm going through puberty, right? That's what my body's supposed to be changing. And I couldn't be good the way God wanted me to be good, so therefore God hated me. And as I got more and more into drinking and using drugs, I actually was evil. So God had good reason. But if this God existed... So I said to him, what's knowledge of God's will for me? And he didn't answer me right away. He thought about it. He said, I don't want to answer that right away. So I came back to him and said, how do I know God's will for me? Which is the gist of this question. This, I think, dovetails nicely with what Bill said, but it was just a little more practical application. And he said, Matthew, I think you're making this too complicated. Bless you, sir. He said, you're making this too complicated. He said, when you wake up in the morning and the alarm clock goes off, God's saying, get up. When a bill comes in the mail and it says, pay this amount, God's saying, hey, pay that amount. When Phoebe's diaper's dirty, God's saying, I think it's time to change the baby. He said, I think if you just do the next indicated thing, you can be sure you're doing God's will. I've said this all over the world, this story. And people come up and say, well, what's the alternative to the next indicated thing? And it's in your head. It's the next grandiose plan. You know, I'm not going to get up and go to this job. I'm going to go, you know, go do some fabulous saintly work and God will love me more. But it turns out I got fired. So now I can't pay my child. You know what I mean? We have this idea that we got a better plan. Just let go of the thought process and do what's in front of you and you're probably doing God's will, which I think will answer this question. I'll get rid of this one. If I surrender completely, will I not be lethargic slug? How do I survive, or how can I succeed, or whatever, without some effort, planning, control? That's an interesting... In other words, how do I let go and let God and still function in life? Well, we just answered that. If you really think God's will is, okay, now you're just going to do my will, and then you lay in bed and wait for his will, right? His will is ringing. It's called an alarm clock, right? His will is calling. It's your mother. His will is the challenge at work. The idea that if you surrender completely everything, and it's a worthy experiment, try it. Try surrendering completely. Take a Saturday and see if you really just become a lethargic slug. I think you'll find you become unencumbered by the narrator. The narrator is not the experience, right?
Or lock yourself in a closet and see if God pokes hot dogs through the keyhole.
Well, like Bill and I like this, and Jay, this guy Ram Dass, right? He's a guy from the 60s, kind of a LSD experimenter, became a big meditator and went to India. But he, you know, people say, well, what will happen? The same question. He said, well, look, if you're like a war protester, right, you're protesting the war, and then you have a spiritual awakening that it doesn't matter, it's all consciousness unfolding, try not protesting the war. It's your nature. You're just going to do it. God programmed you. Does this help? Whoever asked these questions?
Yes.
Jay?
How can I get over my prejudice to the God concept?
Oh, I should do that.
Go ahead. I think he's a good one. We can debate it. Go ahead.
Ladies.
God. When I say God, I'm not saying what you think I'm saying. When I say God, I'm talking about an experience that I found in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what I'm talking about. If you came up to me and you stuck a gun in my belly and you said, tell me about God and make it really good, or I'm going to pull the trigger, I would give you the line that Silkworth says in the book, when he says that these men and women believe in each other, but they believe even more in the power that brings chronic alcoholics back from the gates of insanity and death. I have experience with that power. But if you have problem with God, the God concept, come up with another word. Try truth. Try good. Try peace. Those will all work. Those will all work. And the wonderful thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is that we will never presume to tell you what aspect of the power you have to find. But you got to find one. Again, it's back to an experiment. There is no way to get around a closed mind. And most people that I know that are agnostics or atheists do not want to do the experiment. So what they'll do is they'll say, it's stupid. There's a guy I sponsor who, like when we got to the third step, he just skipped it because he thought it was stupid.
So... Are you still going? Okay. So, I lost my train. Go ahead, Bill.
So, a guy comes to me, and it's time to do the third step. And I look at him, and I say, because I do the real embarrassing stuff, man. I get on my knees with him and hold hands, and we pray. It's really stupid. You know, and... I look at him and I go, are you ready to do the third step? And he looks right at me and he goes, no. And I go, why not? And he says, well, I have a problem with God. I look right at him and I go, so do I. Let's pray. This one particular guy looked at me and he goes, he was shocked, you know, because the argument goes away when you say something like that, because you know, because you agree with them, but you're going to pray anyway, and they get confused. And one guy looked at me and he said, well, I don't even believe in God. And I looked right at him and I go, nobody really does. Let's pray. Because if you stop and think about it, if you stop and think about the whole God thing, it's just stupid. I mean, it's like there's no logical progression. There's no evidence. There's nothing. I mean, if you sit and conceptualize it, it really is quite lame, unless you're raised in it because you just don't know any better and your logic process isn't working well. So you just kind of blindly believe because you've been taught to do that. So this is what I came to AA with. This is this attitude that I came to Alcoholics Anonymous with.
It was really a lot of fun.
It has dogged me throughout my life. I mean, I was raised without any kind of religion or anything like this. You know, I wasn't raised to be a free thinker. We just didn't think. I developed my own thinking mechanism about what's right or wrong and did some reading and stuff and came to this conclusion. And to this day, if you pin me down at 26 years sober, and I meditate and I pray sometimes. I'm not much of a prayer, but I meditate, you know, quite a bit now compared to what I used to do. I still hold the same belief mechanism. I have the same, if I sit and think about it conceptually, I can't come to any other conclusion. But I've had experiences that have changed how I feel about it, the nature about it. My term for God is manager. It's the manager. I'm powerless. I am not God. I am powerless. Therefore, I need a manager, somebody that's going to restore me to enough to sanity, certainly enough sanity to not drink and use, but also enough sanity to recognize the powerlessness. That's the root of my problem, is I think I have power and control. And when I look out in nature and it's all running, you know, I mean, I start reading these guys some years ago, you know, that it's more of an Eastern type of thing, a non-dual thing. This one guy calls it intelligence energy. I mean, and you can look at it and go, there it is. I mean, there's something is happening. Something is happening. Here it is. Is it intelligent? Is it conscious? Who knows? The best definition of faith I've ever heard is faith is not knowing and having that be okay. It's not belief, faith in a belief mechanism that I've contrived to make so that I understand that when I die there'll be an afterlife because I can't imagine myself not existing any longer because I'm self-obsessed. So we're going to make up stories about how we're going to continue on forever. You know, I can't do that. I can't go there. I can't grasp that at all. But I can grasp that when I lose that sense of self and I become connected to the whole of all things, I get that. I can feel that. I can have the experience of that. So is there a God in my life? You know, yes. But like Jay says, it's not the word that you think what it means to me. Eckhart Tolle uses the term being, just being connected, you know. And I get that, and it works in my life. It's changed my life.
So we'll probably move to form five, right, to stay on schedule, and okay. Then we'll come back to questions.
Okay.
Just, you know, the long and the short of it is it's a concept for me, and when I was drinking and lying and thinking of only myself, things conspired against me. They really did. There were things outside my control that went horribly wrong that caused me jail time and other things, but I had a connection. When I started thinking about other people and praying and meditating, things conspired completely the other direction. I've had amazing gifts handed me. So whatever you, it's the concept that's the problem. You know, the evidence is sitting here.
Yes.
So four.
I think I can do this in 5 minutes.
All right, whatever you think.
Yeah. Step four. There's a lot of information around that pretends that the fourth step is difficult. It's a problem. This is only comes from people who haven't done it. Okay? I did my first inventory when I was 23 days sober. Okay? It took me about 7 hours. All right? What needs to be on that first inventory is the greatest hits. What needs to be on that first inventory, you know, like people say, oh, it's difficult. Poppycock.
coffee.
What we're asking any alcoholic woman or man to do is go home and write a list of who you hate. You do this every night when you go home. Then, after you get done, I mean, how long is that going to take? You've been working on it forever. You know, I mean, and then we want you to write down what you're afraid of. Her mother. Her sister. I mean, you know, I mean, it's Los Angeles County Sheriffs. I mean, it's not that deep. I mean, my sponsor taught me entire political parties are fine. You know, I mean, what we're talking about, especially in the first inventory, is getting down into the stuff that isn't like things that are buried. You know, I mean, it's the stuff that's on your consciousness all the time. I like to call it the rotisserie. You know, it's that stuff that goes around and around and around. And everybody in this room knows what I'm talking about. That's the stuff that needs to be on there. You know, then the sexual weirdness. I woke up with a yak. You know, I mean, yak again. Okay. So I got a problem with redheads. We'll just... But so that's all it is. The reason I believe that alcoholism is more a disease today than I did 32 years ago is I've heard lots and lots of fifth steps, and they're all the same. Sam Shoemaker, Bill Wilson's spiritual mentor, said that there's only one sin. Only one? Thinking that I'm different. And after all these inventories I've heard, they're all the same. I mean, we're alcoholic males. We're just not that complex. There's only so much we can do to destroy ourselves. Some of us may be a little more flamboyant than others.
Creative.
You know, some may have a little more money. But, I mean, that's really the mechanisms that we use to destroy ourselves are the same. So, get over it. Let's get on. So that's the most important thing. The one piece of personal experience that I think is really vital for me to share with you is that the sickest that I got in Alcoholics Anonymous was between about 4 and 11 years sober as far as my personal recovery went. Now, I was doing great. I did some of the best work that I ever... Sickest isn't the proper term. I'm sorry. It's not the... I'll come up with it.
Full of self.
Yeah. Well, I was sober, man.
Yes, he was
sober. Armed with steps, concepts, and traditions, able to transcend everything and save alcoholics everywhere.
Yeah, he's sober, man.
There were a lot of guys that
That's
I...
That's how come I got so fucked up. That was my example.
Of course, he had no problem with God.
Well, I was president of AA, though.
Yeah. But anyway, what happened was is that I did not sit down and do a rigorous, vigorous inventory. What I would do is I'd talk with guys that I was sponsoring about the problems that I was having. My sponsor and I, every year, would get together, and I would do a fifth step with a current. I'd write an inventory, and what I would do is I would list the same problems that I'd had 4 years. He knew him as well as I did. It was kind of a mutual non-aggression pact. We got to work on that. And that these were just the problems I was having, and that's it. When I was 14 years sober, I hit a wall, and I probably wrote the best inventory that I've written. I still keep it and show it to the guys when I had a really wonderful experience of going through a step workshop with a group of guys. There were we start out with 18 of us, and I think 15 of us actually went through the whole thing. One person ran away and started his own group, which worked correctly. And
he wasn't doing it right.
I wasn't doing it right.
Clearly.
Yeah, again. And But anyway, what happened is, for me, is that my life changed in a remarkable fashion, and I got to watch for the first time. I'd seen guys one-on-one do it was something I was familiar with, but to see 14 of us a year later, none of our lives were the same. And we all did a very, very thorough inventory, and since then, I just won't go 3 years without sitting down and just clearing the decks with a brand new big book, with a brand new format that I haven't used before. You know, there were years, you know, I mean, when I was sober, man, there were things that needed to be done correctly. Now there are things that need to be done. And putting the spiritual principles in action from a new perspective is a wonderful, wonderful thing to do. You aren't going to get hurt doing a different format of writing an inventory. No lightning. Some of my friends in AA, my technician friends, you know, you're killing alcoholics, but really, it's within the process this power comes in and works. So if you're sitting around and you haven't done a real thorough house cleaning because you're a sober man or sober woman, and I understand, I mean, it's a wonderful, effective place to be. But my experience is the past, 18 years now, it's worked a lot better every 3 years sitting down and really blowing the decks out. So, not bad.
Fifth step. I'm going to contradict a little. Well, I'm going to give my experience. It might contradict some of the things Jay said. So,
but I honor and worship him.
Yeah. No, I when I was new, again, I want to tell my experience, and I'd like to talk about both sides of the aisle, giving a fifth step to someone and hearing a fifth step, because I think there's huge benefits in both. But when my first sponsor, we read the book. As we got to a step, we did the step. We did the third step on our knees in his kitchen, holding hands, praying. And then he said, here's the four columns. He actually opened my notebook, and he wrote a line, and he wrote a line. He said, here's the name, go. And I walked around with an empty notebook and asked people, and I couldn't think of how to put resentments, and had many funny experiences. My sober brother said, well, have you ever had sex with a prostitute? I said, no. He said, have you ever had sex with our dog? I said, no. And he goes, well, then you're like better than most of the people I've had. And he was trying to get me to start writing. And then I said, have you had sex with a prostitute? And he goes, this is your inventory. But then a guy, Rotten Ron, said one day in a meeting, not even talking to me, he was looking out into space and he said, you know, the way I did this is I just pictured myself in a room with a door. And whoever I didn't want to see come through that door, I wrote down as the name. And that really got me going. So, but I'm raised Catholic, so I wrote pages of paragraphs of my sins, right? And I had some good ones, you know, and really gnarly stuff that I thought, and I wrote it all down. I was so nervous, and I went over to my sponsor's house, and we went down in his rec room. It was really weird. He goes, I'm going to go in an apartment complex. But he said, nobody ever goes there. My wife's here, and she wanders in and out, so let's go down there. And we close the door, and I turn to him, and I just start barfing up all my sins, and I'm like, but then I did this, and I'm crying, I'm like, I can't believe it, but then I did that, and then I'm like, you're going to hate me when I tell you this, but then I did that, and he's just sitting there like a train came through the room, and he's like, wow. And when I got done, I read the whole thing, pages, and he goes, he didn't say a word the whole time, and he had a toothpick in his mouth, and he goes, wow, that was great. He said, wasn't a fifth step, but it was great. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, what happened to the four columns I drew for you? Where is that? And I flipped over and he goes, okay, I want you to go home and I want you to think of someone you resent right now and I want you to write his name right there. And guess who I wrote? Him. Yeah. Because he let me say the whole thing, right? And so I went and I did, and it was easy after that. After I already kind of exposed myself, I wrote the resentments, I wrote the fears, I wrote the sex stuff, and there was a benefit to doing that format. Yeah. There was a real benefit. It was a different experience for me. Then I got a different sponsor, still not Bill, but found a guy, because that guy just, he got unavailable to me. It wasn't because I disagreed with him or didn't like him. He became unavailable, and I couldn't reach him. His wife had, would not tell him I called. A lot of weird stuff happened, and through a series of misunderstandings. But I got another sponsor, and he said, look, if you're going to do this with me, if I'm going to be your sponsor, you need to do a fifth step. I need to know your modus operandi. I need to know who I'm dealing with. And if you do a fifth step, and by then I'm a couple years sober, so I get out the columns and I do it. And the experience I had then, there were twofold. One is that it's easy to talk about all the stuff you did when you were under the influence of drugs and alcohol, because who isn't kind of a jackass when you're doing that, right? But now I'm a couple years sober, and it was very sobering to look at that, because a lot of it was sober behavior and unbelievably deceptive and manipulative. And, well, now it's not unbelievable. I was just really full of myself and thought it was unbelievable. It's pretty run-of-the-mill. But I read this to him, and he did me a great favor. As I read it, he said, hey, hey, do you see the pattern? You see how you manipulate people, you manipulate women here? And you don't tell them the truth, and then they love you, and then you don't like them because they don't know you because you didn't tell them the truth. You see that? And I'd be like, wow, that's kind of weird. And we'd read some more stuff, and he'd go, oh, wow. He goes, do you see the pattern here with your family? And he'd show me the pattern. I go, oh, huh. And I went through the whole thing, and he really did learn my modus operandi. And you know who else learned my modus operandi? Me. I had never looked at it. So when I went to 6 and 7, I knew what they were. And the final thing I'll say is hearing a fifth step is a great privilege. And I just love AA, and I love my mentors, and I was so excited the first time I heard a fifth step. And I think I was actually being sponsored by Bill. I didn't get any sponsees, although I fished and fished and fished until I was like 3 years sober. And it was Jeff, remember, dude? Yeah. And I said, hey, I'm going to hear this guy's fifth step. And I go, I can't, you know, it's, I'm so excited. I can't wait. I got a little room. My wife's going to take the kids to the park, and it's going to be so exciting. I go, what's your best advice, Bill? And he goes, try to stay awake.
Yeah.
And I was like, what? Yeah, he goes, good luck, have fun. And
it's not good when you yawn.
And you know, the thing is we talked about it here, is what I have found, and the great gift for me, and I told you about my friend the bank robber's moment where I said, do you think because of all these things God doesn't love you and I love you? I don't know what that did for him. It transformed me as a human being to be able to love someone as they were with all their stuff hanging out and know that because of that, that something, that the animating force clearly is still flowing in the right direction for that person because they've freed themselves. So what I like to make sure I do is stay alert enough to add my humanity to their four-step. If the guy's having trouble telling me about his sexual stuff, I tell him about my sexual stuff. If a guy really thinks this thing that he did is the worst thing that anyone can possibly do, I tell him the worst thing I did. And like Bill said, sometimes you can't top him, but you can walk right beside him and say, you know, this, like the other night I heard one, the guy did it, came up to my other little house up where I work, separate from my home, and he came up there and did it, and he left out a bunch of stuff. And he said, well, I already did a four-step. And I said, well, I'm your new sponsor. Why don't you list the stuff that you're going to take to the grave? And he sat in my car after I took a cake at the Thursday night meeting, and he told me the list. And what I was able to say to him is, I have heard this all. I've heard it all over and over and over. It's okay. You know, I didn't do everything he did, but we do. You know, like Jay said, they're all the same. It's all about, you know, color. It doesn't matter. So that humanity, I think, is very important, because what you're trying to do is rectify that sin of thinking we're different. You know? And if you can say, it's okay, you're not different. And any way you can do that. And I'm really pretty high on this Clint Hodges CD I listened to recently, and I just will offer this to you because I know there's a lot of people in here who sponsor people. He does a thing with the resentments, is as they read their resentments, he writes down what he thinks the rule that person has, that the person on the resentment list broke. So that makes it a resentment, right? And the rules are often kind of crazy, right? Like, and I actually had an experience recently where I wrote down what rule did this person break I had unrealistic expectations of what my wife is supposed to do for me emotionally. She's supposed to be sensitive to me all the time, and I'm not supposed to have to return that favor. She's supposed to know when to be light and when to be serious and when to be listening and when to be loving and when to be affectionate, when to have sex with me and when not to have sex with me. It's ridiculous, this rule I have in my head. It's ridiculous. And she doesn't belong on that resentment list. And the resentment is always about my perception. It's not about the reality. So I actually have one more thing to say. We have a couple minutes. Scott Redmond taught me this, because if you're hearing a fifth step, there will be something that they say that's almost impossible to find their part in. Many of us were molested as children. Many of us. Many of us were just abused physically. Many of us. And what do you say? What's your part in that resentment? Where's the fourth column, the freeing part? Where's the part that's going to make me free? And Scott Redmond, he's a good friend of Bill's and Jay's, but I knew him. He gave a great example. He said when he was 10 years old or so, he was at his cousin's house, and his aunt was in charge, and his cousin lied and said that he had done some awful thing. And the aunt held his arms behind his back and let his cousin pummel him. So he got beaten while the authority figure was holding him helpless. And he said the appropriate response to that is lack of confidence in authority, feeling ashamed, feeling betrayed, feeling unsafe. So those are all the feelings I had when I was 10 years old. He said the inappropriate response is being 45 years old and still motherfucking her at Thanksgiving. Right? He said the resentment is what you carry and carry and carry. So no matter what happened, we have had crimes done unto us. We have. And we have done crimes unto people. But the fourth column sometimes is, why are you still carrying it? Why did that person who perpetrated that event live with you for so long? Is it time now to set it down?
The thing about that too is in that fourth column, it does not say in the book, it does not say what was my part. It says what were my faults and mistakes. So in a situation like what Matthew described, my fault and mistake is I'm unforgiving. At the very least. So now we're into forgiveness, which is much more an art form than anything else. You know, how do you just forgive? You know? Also, the fifth step, what Jay talked about, there's an odd thing that happens between 4 and 12 years sober. You know, I mean, there's a shift that occurs for most of us when we're around. What I like to describe it is that the sheer weight of my personality just crushed me. You know, carrying around the Bill C. persona is a heavy load. Man. It's like
just being an extra on the set is just.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it takes you got to get. I mean, it takes a village, you know, to carry that thing around. You know, to support it, and it just flattened my ass. And at 10 years, I did an inventory that would have killed a lesser man. I mean, it was. I did it with intent. You know, I mean, I was in trouble. I was hurting. I was a mess. I had some sort of an emotional breakdown. You know, so like a nervous breakdown, people would call. I fell apart. My whole life changed. Everything changed around it. And that inventory, I mean, I sat down and did it. By that time, by 10 years sober, I knew it wasn't you. I knew that now. It looked like you. It smelled like you. And, you know, everything told me it was you, but I knew. I'd listened to enough fifth steps and read that book enough times and done enough work to where I knew it was me. It, no matter how much I couldn't see it, I knew it was me. And that inventory at 10 years sober, I think, really had a lot to do with changing my life around. I mean, I was really looking for my part. My faults and mistakes. The ones I've done since, Man, you can just like fast forward right to the fourth column.
Yeah.
You know, the names that you put on the resentment list are almost irrelevant. You know, because you know that it's me. It's not even them. You know,
Mr. Why Pink, Mr. Them? Blue, Mr. Orange.
One, two, three. You know, I'm like, oh, shit. I'm arrogant, pompous, you know, false expectations. One of them that came out recently with Clayton, you know, is that I had adjusted myself, made myself be a different kind of person in order to have a relationship with this man, to be his friend. Mm-hmm. And then when the stuff came down and I stood up for myself and I disagreed with him, he cut me out of his life. So I thought, you know, why would that guy? Well, he hadn't changed. He was the same guy. He was true to himself. He looked at me like, where the hell did you come from? You know? Because I had adapted. Finally, I couldn't stand it anymore, and I stood up for myself. And he goes, well, geez, you're not the person I thought you were. I thought it was him. That he was an asshole. Well, he might be an asshole. I mean, he's consistent in his asshole. But me, I switched asshole.
Midstream.
Midstream, you know? And that came out in the inventory. As I was sitting down there hovering over that, like, what did I put? And it came to me. And it wasn't before that. I didn't know what I was going to write down. When it came down, I went, well, Jesus. I mean, it was like a revelation, you know, that it wasn't him. It was me again. It's always me. So it's a very good exercise. And I also believe, just quickly, that you can get all these manuals, and Jay's really good. He'll try them all out, you know, and then he reports back so I don't have to. You know, it's like, yeah. But you know, the herb one and all that, you know, I mean, some of them, these 15 column expanded versions and changing all the statements into questions, and you look at that stuff and it just seems overwhelming. And my personal feeling about it, I don't think that was ever the intent of the inventory. It's not self-analysis, you know, it's not chapter and verse. We're looking at the immovable parts of the inventory. What isn't working? Resentments, fears, and broken relationships as an end result of being full of resentment and fear. If that's what you're bringing to the table, what are your relationships going to look like? You know, I don't think there's anything wrong with doing these things. You know, we have a new format now we're using in these groups that I put together. We've been doing these groups for 15 plus years. Yeah. You know, where we put four or five people together and go through the steps as a group. And I call it sponsor school, so that we understand the mechanics better, so that we're able to carry the message better, not so much for self-discovery. Right. And you get a bunch of guys that have been around a little bit and have done inventories before, and they bring a lot to the table, and you start discussing some of this stuff. Now, whenever I do one of these groups, I do a little inventory. You know, I mean, it's like, but God, my resentments are so pathetic now.
Yeah.
You know, but you keep that pipe clean, you know. I used to say it's not about inventory after inventory after inventory, and I still believe that. That's another form of self-obsession. But there's something about being current. And the other thing is, I've done fifth steps with Matthew. I do fifth steps now with other guys that I sponsor in order to break down that barrier of the sponsor-sponsee. You know, because now I'm dealing with guys that are 15, 20 years sober, and we've been together for a long time. It's not like we're newcomers anymore. And I don't want there to be this illusion that I'm somebody other than what I seem to be. So I'll do the fifth steps to break down that barrier between sponsor and sponsee. And that has really helped me a lot, just the whole ego thing about it all.
I want to drop two quick things in. Number one is, and thank you very much for bringing this up, and kids, it's taped and all that. The four-column inventory and the inventory that's in the big book is the way to go, absolutely. And it was the way that I did it in the beginning, and I did not mean a free-form inventory at all. And when I was speaking about the different formats, I was talking about all the different things that I've tried over the years, because I'm growing in effectiveness and intelligence. And if I'm 32 years sober, and if I'm not doing stuff that's spiritually weird, that's intellectually challenging, that's a little bit different, then what use am I being to you? If I'm just telling you what it was that I was telling you 15 years ago, or 20 years ago, or the first time that we did this, what am I bringing to the table? The other thing that's wonderful when looking at the four step is the word resentment comes from a French word, ressentir, which means to refeel. And if you ever want to know what it is that needs to be on that list, you know, I say who you hate, but when I'm talking about, you know, what getting at first, it's just what are you re-feeling? And that's it. And it doesn't take long. The people that designed this thing, you know, Bill and Bill did his in the hospital in a couple of minutes. This stuff, people were on because they were working with drunks. This thing that we have nowadays, we don't have the same mechanism of working with other alcoholics. And I believe that this whole thing that we're doing with the book and all the study and all that stuff is a response to what happened in the mid-'80s when the hospital programs came out. Mm-hmm. And people were telling us what Alcoholics Anonymous was. And Alcoholics Anonymous, not officially, but just grassroots, we got into this thing of going through the literature. Turning pages is where it's at. And you can't do this. You can't do this wrong.
Yeah.
Because God, the power is in charge. You know, people can leave. Anyway, just do it. Just do it.
You can't hurt him.
Yeah, that's right. The first guy that I sponsored when I had 28 days sober, a guy asked me to sponsor him, and I got a hold of my sponsor, and I said, "What do I do?" And he said, "You say yes." Really? He said, "Jay, if they're sick enough to ask you for help, you can't possibly hurt them."
It's true.
That's a good spot to stop.
Yeah, okay, thank you.
Let's have lunch, you guys.
Hey, John Gunn.